Joining me next is Michael Kremer. He's an acclaimed development economist and the current Gates Professor of Developing Societies at Harvard University. He is a research affiliate at Innovations for Poverty Action, an organization very closely affiliated with the EA movement that focuses on rigorous evidence-based initiatives in helping work on some of the worst conditions happening in developing countries. He's a Giving What We Can member, and he's founded a program to help graduate students explore firsthand the kinds of problems that they so often work with in a hypothetical or policy space. So without further ado, take the stage.
Great, thank you very much. Before I put on that hat, let me just briefly mention another hat that I have that relates to the last presentation, which is I'm scientific director for a part of U.S. Agency for International Development called Development Innovation Ventures. And I think that is, and you know, my experience very much echoes that of Sebastian, a lot of people wanting to do the right thing, but also a big role that I think people from this movement can bring to it. And in particular, as he highlighted, one role is evidence, and that's a particular focus of Development Innovation Ventures. So we provide funding, and I know some people out here are involved in initiatives, either to pilot a new idea. So that's relatively small amounts of funding by U.S. government standards, or to rigorously test it. And then for those efforts that have you know, rigorous evidence of impact and cost effectiveness or of passing a market test, evidence to try to transition that to scale. So I encourage people who are interested in, you know, have ideas that they think might be appropriate to visit our website and consider applying if you think it's appropriate. Or, you know, if you're we don't have positions available right now, but if you're interested in working in this type of environment, monitor our website as well in case we have positions open. Just to reinforce one other point that came up on the importance of developing country governments, to pick up on both Alan and Rachel's comment. So the work that the U.S. government is doing and the British government doing is incredibly important on this area. But the Indian government made a huge contribution in this area, and that was in part based on the evidence. They brought the treatment of neglected tropical diseases to hundreds of millions of more, somewhere between 100 and 200 million more people on a sustained basis, overwhelmingly with Indian government funds. People in this room, J-PAL, Evidence Action, many others played a big role in that. So to put on my academic hat, there's a question for effective altruists of, at what point do you stop collecting evidence, and at what point do you start acting? And I would argue that those are two very different questions, and that's part of what I'll be arguing in this. But how much evidence do we need for each of those decisions? So if you think that a goal for effective altruists is maximizing the impact of the resources that they have, you can think of let's start by thinking about a really simple case, a case where either something works or it doesn't work, then is it worth spending resources on it? Well, you just take the probability of the impact times the value of the impact. And you make the decision based on that. More generally, though, there might be a range of possible impacts. Let's take this example that came up, the example of deworming. Well, it might have, there's multiple studies out there with estimating different impacts. You could assign some probability in a particular location of each of those impacts, and then you just sum up over each of the possible range impacts times the probability of that impact, and then you see if that justifies the use of the resources. Okay. Now, how do you value that? Well, for utilitarians, the value would be in welfare or utility terms, and I'll explain why that's important in a second. If you're thinking this formula here looks very much like the formula for an investment decision, if you're a private investor. But there's one big difference, and I think that comes from, and I'll explain that in the slide. So key concept in economics, and just, you know, and for effective altruists in particular, is diminishing marginal utility of money. If you have a little bit of money, you'll spend it on things that are incredibly important, like having enough food to eat. As you get more and more money, you can move down a hierarchy of priorities, generally, I mean, this may be a slight oversimplification, to things like, you know, getting a bigger screen TV, for example. And that improves happiness and welfare, but probably not as much as for a family that doesn't have enough food to get enough food. So what are the implications of that? Well, one is that if you can transfer resources to the poorest, that's going to generally improve welfare. But once you wouldn't transfer a huge amount to one poor person to get them to the point where they could live a life where they're having a, you know, extremely large flat screen TV. You would say, well, let's keep helping the poorest person once we've provided a bit of help to another. And that means that whereas for an individual, if they think about how do they want to take on risk, well, for an individual, if I take on a financial risk, say a gamble for a large gamble, if I'm going to bet $1 million and give up $1 million in assets for the possibility of winning $2 million, well, the formula that I put up earlier, if it's expressed in dollar terms, that would say I wouldn't want to take, I might take that risk, but it shouldn't be in dollar terms, it should be in welfare terms. And the first $1 million means a lot more to me than the second $1 million, so I won't take an actuarially fair gamble of $1 million versus $2 million. On the other hand, if you're thinking about a situation as an effective altruist and transfers, well, there it's quite different because you're not going to be moving down that curve of diminishing marginal utility very far. A 50% chance of getting a $10 per person benefit for 100 people is roughly equivalent to a 100% chance of reaching 50 people, or a 100% chance of $5 benefit per person. So these are all roughly, because people's lives, even poor people's lives, their overall lifetime income is not going to be that affected by, it'll be better off, but it's not going to, the diminishing marginal utility won't really hit that level. So that's an implication of basic economic theory for effective altruists, and I'll come back to that in a second on this question of evidence. One other implication of diminishing marginal utility is that if you're thinking about how to spend your money and how to give away your money, there's a big cost for waiting. Why? Because the world is, you know, right now, poverty is diminishing at a rapid rate. There's huge economic growth in many low-income countries. And that means that spending your money now, while people are still poor, has an advantage over waiting. And obviously, you can earn some money in the bank by keeping your money in the bank, but the interest rate probably won't make up for that. Okay. So I'll, in general, argue that if you're a standard utilitarian, which I understand many of the philosophers here are, then you should be pretty close to risk neutral in thinking about alternative investments in transferring to the poor. And by the way, there's all sorts of other areas that effective altruists are interested in, and existential risk, et cetera. I'm not going to comment on those. I'm going to focus on poverty, extreme poverty. That's the area that I know. And within that, I'm going to focus on a few examples, which are also examples I know. So I don't want to argue that there aren't, you know, other very important causes. Okay, so let me just note here, if you're not a utilitarian, maybe you have some other approach and you care a lot about, you really don't like risk, or you really don't like ambiguity, which some people distinguish from risk. Well, then you might want to support a charity like GiveDirectly, which is, you know, I think it's just transferring money to poor people. It's very hard to see how that could go wrong, and you know, you can be quite confident. Or if you're very pessimistic about other alternatives. I would argue probably if you have to be very pessimistic to, but if you're very pessimistic about other alternatives, you could go for give directly. Or if you're thinking about a general policy change and you think a lot of development spending is spent badly, and if you're pessimistic about that, you might say, well, better to move that all to something like give directly. Okay. But let me just go back to this this formula, summing up the probabilities of different outcomes times the value of those outcomes. So what are the implications of that? Well, one implication is that, as effective altruists, I think, recognize, high risk but very high payoff investments may be very reasonable, may be worth investing in. So if there's existential risks, maybe it's worth investing in addressing those. I'm not qualified to say whether they are or not, but conceptually it makes sense. Another implication is there might be high-risk investments that are not of the existential sort, but you've got a candidate HIV vaccine, very unlikely to work, but the payoff from having an HIV vaccine would be huge. It may be worth investing in that. And I think those are things that the community generally recognizes. I think there's a little bit of a I don't want to claim everybody, but I think in the evidence-oriented community, there may not be a full appreciation for another implication of this, which is that if you're looking at more, not these extremely low probabilities, but you're looking at moderate probabilities, you should be using the same formula. And so if you can generate a dollar for the poor with 99% probability, and let's say for which I think you can through give directly or others, or if you can generate $1.25 for the poor with probability 0.8, you might want to take the alternative that involves some risk, and that's not a judgment. I'm not going to make the judgment here about what those probabilities are. But if you're really interested in, each person may have to evaluate what they think those probabilities are. But if you're serious about this, you have to think about what the probabilities are and what the values are. And you need to use all the information that you can in trying to estimate those values, all the relevant information, both the values and the probabilities. So let me just give an example. And I'll give the example of deworming that Alan mentioned. So if you think about mass drug administration for worms in a population, what type of evidence might you consider? Well, there's RCT evidence on mass drug administration, and I've done some academic work on this, including the most recent is a new meta-analysis of multiple studies, which is on my website, just to plug that a little bit. I'm also discussing that in a smaller group on Tuesday. But you wouldn't only consider that. You'd also think about, there's also RCT evidence on deworming people who are known to be infected. And surely, with any reasonable model of the world, the evidence on the impact of deworming people who are known to be infected is relevant in thinking about what's the impact of treating a population in which, say, half the people are infected. And I think even the critics of mass drug administration would acknowledge that there's an impact on that people who are infected should be treated, and that that's highly cost-effective. But you'd also think about evidence from non-randomized studies that have address potential confounding factors. So if it's a bad non-randomized study, well, you wouldn't want to think about it. But if it does a good job of addressing confounding factors, that should enter into the analysis as well. I'm not saying necessarily with the same weight as a randomized trial, but it should be part of your thought process. And again, to give a final example, you should also think about the underlying science. So I'll give an example. The underlying science, would definitely suggest that in populations where there's more people with worms, the benefits are likely to be greater than in populations where there's fewer people with worms. Why is that relevant? Well, if we think about policy, think about the people at the World Health Organization. They recommend mass drug administration, and what they have come up with is a 20% prevalence threshold for recommending mass deworming. If it's below that, they think it's not worth it. If it's above it, they think it is worth it. Now, when they're making that decision, there's just not sufficient evidence to know for sure that 20% is the exact right cutoff. That was based on a judgment call, and they have to take into account, you know, they should be taking, I don't know whether, you know, exactly how they came, you know, what the full process was, but they should be taking into account the available evidence now so they can make recommendations. A lot of developing countries will go with their recommendation and follow their recommendation. They've got to make some choice. Even if they want more evidence, they've got to recommend something now. And the approach which makes sense is to say, based on the existing evidence, what should we do? Now, another question, and I would argue a very different question, is should you invest in collecting additional evidence? Well, there, I think you should apply the same approach, and that's what standard decision theory would suggest. You invest in additional evidence if the cost of collecting that evidence is less than the expected value of the evidence. And what's the expected value of the evidence? You know, let's say there might be a pure science value, and I don't want to dismiss that, but from a utilitarian perspective, it would be the probability the additional evidence will change the future decision times the expected value of changing the decision if indeed it changes the decision. So to be a little bit more concrete, and there's some assumptions behind this, which I won't go into detail here. Imagine there's a very low probability something's going to work. Like, let's say a perpetual motion machine. We have strong reason to believe that won't work. Then it doesn't make sense to invest a lot of resources in building the perpetual motion machine on a mass scale and having a factory to build that. But it also, it's so low a probability that even though it would be great to have a perpetual motion machine, it probably doesn't make sense to invest millions of dollars in research for it. Okay. Now, let's say it's a somewhat higher probability. So still low, but somewhat higher. Let's say there's a new approach to teaching math or language that there's no evidence for, but based on theoretical grounds, we think it might be pretty effective. Well, it might not yet be time to implement that at scale, because perhaps there's negative effects of that. But it probably does make sense to do some sort of staged investment in evidence. So the first stage probably wouldn't be a full RCT. The first stage would probably be, let's pilot this in a couple of schools, see what the reaction is, see if it looks like it's you know, even feasible to go on to the next stage or appropriate to go on to the next stage. Then, eventually, you might decide we're going to have a full-scale RCT. Let's say it's a higher probability. Okay, I'm going to put flossing as an example there, because I just saw a newspaper article about it, and the newspaper article pointed out, and I know nothing about flossing, so let me be clear about this. It said that the RCT evidence for this is not strong, but the dentists continue to recommend it. Well, you know, my guess would be that the dentists, I don't know, and I haven't investigated this, but my guess would be that the dentists probably know what they're talking about and have some reason to believe this. And even if there are not many RCTs of flossing have been conducted, there are probably not a lot of statistical power to them, et cetera. So probably the best thing to do for your health is to continue flossing for now. But we should probably also collect additional evidence. But let me talk about something on the other side of that line. Let's say there is evidence for it, enough for a new drug to get past the FDA. Well, that's then, you know, probably if you have the disease, you should consider taking the drug or take the drug if it's recommended for other medical reasons. But does that mean we should stop collecting evidence? Almost certainly not. We might not need to do more randomized trials. Maybe we should be doing additional randomized trials, even though it's already passed the FDA. But certainly we should be collecting some data on what the impact of this drug is from could there be side effects that the FDA missed in its initial trial? Certainly. So it's worth investing in additional evidence in many of these cases. Despite the fact that there's enough that based on the current evidence, it makes sense to go ahead. If we're not very, very certain, it may well be worth getting additional evidence, particularly if that can be done cheaply. If there's a super high probability of something, and if it's costly enough to do tests, then it's no longer worth collecting more evidence. Okay. And what are the cutoffs? I use these vague terms of extremely low, low, high, extremely high. Well, the cutoffs will depend on the cost of the evidence collection. In particular, they, to be technical, they'll depend on the option values associated with the stage of experimentation. So some, in some cases, you might be able to experiment very cheaply to get it, and then you have to think, well, what's the chance it's going to pass this stage? If it passes this stage, what's the chance of going on, that it should, it'll pass the next stage, et cetera. But let me contrast this whole approach with one where, which I think is common in some communities, and while I think it's less common in the effective altruism community, I don't think it's entirely absent. And that's one that sort of artificially discretizes these continuous probabilities into two areas. An area where something is unproven, and we say, well, we can't invest in it because it's unproven, and we keep doing more research while it's still in the unproven category. And then there's a sort of black and white transition to another category where it's proven and you stop doing research. And that's not what would come out of a decision theory approach. You would have different cutoffs for when you implement something. You'd act now based on the best available evidence, but you would continue to collect additional evidence as long as enough residual uncertainty remains that there's a chance you're going to change your mind. And that, I think, is an appropriate approach. There's some, on the technical side, what are some implications for how we analyze evidence? So I think where possible, we should use a Bayesian approach. And that can be hard to do, but I think it's worth the effort. If you don't have a Bayesian approach to statistics, if you have a frequentist approach to statistics, then you need to consider the power of tests. So often you hear about 5% significance level. People want to know that if they find an effect, there's only a 5% chance that it's not really there. But we should be thinking more broadly than that. We should be thinking about the power of a test, which is, and in particular, the power against a particular hypothesis, which is one that involves a cost-benefit analysis, the power against the hypothesis that this is not cost-effective. One way to put this is we need to consider the cost of a false negative as well as the cost of a false positive. Now, all that said, so you might then say, you know, I'm a big proponent of randomized trials. I think I've played an important role in bringing these into development economics. So why I'm now saying, well, we should consider all types of evidence. So why does this just throw all rigor out the window? Well, one, I think it's important to, so what is the reason to have perhaps a special role for randomized trials and for evidence? Well, one, and for formal ways of looking at evidence. So I think one important role is to combat biases that we would otherwise be subject to. So there's psychological biases. People may be, for a variety of reasons, they might be inclined to support the activity with the picture of the cute kid or the cute animal as opposed to the animal that turns out to be, intelligent, but not so cute. There's institutional biases. If there are organizations out there and their survival as an organization and their continued employment of their staff depend on promotion of a particular cause, they're going to promote that cause. It's important to recognize that those biases may exist. And certainly, I think that's true for myself. And I think what can be particularly pernicious about these biases in the development space is that there's a competitive market for donor funds. And people are competing. And how do they compete? Well, they compete by trying to make appeals to people. And those appeals, and these are situations where it's very hard for people to evaluate those appeals. It's not a consumer product that people are using every day. It's not even a politician who you can look at, do they have a track record, a mayor who's say, is the garbage being picked up or is the garbage not being picked up? It's something that if we're interested in the market for aid organizations that raise money in the developed world for the developing world, there's not as many they're dealing with relatively uninformed consumers, and they therefore may face competitive pressure to make these emotional appeals that exploit psychological biases. So it does make sense to have some procedural safeguards. And so I think that's one of the reasons, as well as the fact that you just get better evidence for it, to put some special weight on randomized trials, for example. But it's important to recognize that, you know, that's the reason, that's one reason to have these, and that, but that the fundamental decision should be made based on the full set of evidence, which, you know, the better evidence should get weighted more highly, but in some cases, we just don't have the better evidence. It's very hard to do a randomized trial. We'll never have a randomized trial in Brexit, for example. But, you know, you should go with your best available information. It's also important to recognize that there's a cost of delay. So if, as I mentioned earlier, in the development context, you know, a lot of problems are getting better over time. So if you're concerned about neglected tropical diseases, well, 25 years from now, we expect there's going to be a lot less worms for a whole host of reasons. More people are going to be wearing shoes, et cetera. And it's finally important to recognize that if you wind up going with the safe alternative, the thing with a 0.99 probability of a return of 1 versus the thing with a 70% probability of a return of 10, you know, you're potentially giving up a lot of welfare. Let me just talk about a particular case. Diarrheal disease is a major killer of children in the developing world. The NGO Evidence Action is providing water treatment to millions of people through chlorine dispensers. It's extremely cheap. Chlorine's, you know, a bottle of bleach has enough, that you'd buy at, you know, the drugstore, has enough chlorine in it to treat 70,000 households. So it's very, very cheap. So the estimated cost per life saved or DALI saved is quite low. And what's more, a substantial fraction of that cost is covered by carbon credits. So that implies that the, you know, many-fold return on investment with a conventional valuation of DALI. So I don't want to, this number I'm just putting out for illustrative purposes, I don't want to need to do more work to try and come up with this. But, you know, perhaps something on the 10-to-1 scale. Okay. Now, what's the evidence on this case? So we know for sure, so let me start with the non-randomized trial evidence. Chlorine kills bacteria that cause the key types of diarrheal disease. There's historical evidence from as U.S. cities introduced water treatment, you see reductions in mortality that are very closely timed with the introduction of water treatment. There's RCT evidence as well on the impact of cleaner water. There's many RCT studies on the effect of chlorination, suggesting that reduces mothers reporting, or not suggesting, finding that mothers report child diarrhea went down considerably. But I don't want to claim there's no uncertainty. There is uncertainty. You know, one of the reasons, there are many reasons for it, but let me focus on one. There could be reporting bias. Maybe the mothers who are in the treatment group are reporting a fall in diarrhea, but there wasn't really a fall in diarrhea, or not as big as was suggested. One thing you could theoretically do would be to have blinded trials. But turns out there's just very few of them, and the results are pretty inconclusive. They often conducted in places with very low diarrhea rates, so it makes there's very low, you know, like 1 or 2%, so it's very hard to pick up, have statistical power. There's confounding with other interventions. And so then you have to think, okay, maybe the complete gold standard blinded trial isn't there, but we do have a bunch of RCTs. You have to think to yourself, well, how big do we think the reporting bias is, and what direction does it go? And I've got a slide sort of pointing out that the reporting bias could go either way. The reporting bias could easily lead to an underestimate of the treatment effect, or it could lead to an overestimate of the treatment effect. Standard theories of reporting, and there are theories and evidence on reporting bias, and, you know, they could go in both directions. So let me skip this slide given the time. So what should you do? Well, you know, you should think about, let's adjust for this reporting bias by the mothers. There are other concerns, the mapping from diarrhea to mortality. I'm biased on this. I was involved in research on this topic. I've been involved in multiple things some of them I get convinced by, some of them I don't. But so I would argue that somewhat limits the bias. But I'm definitely I've written on this, so I may have a bias on this. Okay. But there's also organizational, you need to think through a bunch. I think much more important than the question of does chlorination reduce diarrhea is the question of is the organization doing a good job delivering it, et cetera. What's the real cost, et cetera. I've been trying to look into these things a little bit myself to think about how should we direct our own charitable organizations. And I guess my current, I want to collect more evidence on this, my current subjective estimate might be 0.7. When I say 0.7, instead of a 10-to-1 ratio, most of this is not because of any other concerns of my own bias, but with my, let's say I put it's very subjective numbers, but I would drop off a 20 or 25% for my own bias. So that might take me from 10 to 1 to 7 to 1 benefit-cost ratio. But it looks huge. And I'm therefore, my wife and I are thinking about how to donate our contributions. Evidence Action is something that we currently intend to donate to. I mean, obviously, we're going to collect, we're still in the stage of collecting evidence and analyzing that evidence, not by doing more RCTs, but by looking at the numbers of Evidence Action, et cetera. But that's our current inclination. I will stress again, this isn't meant to be. There are many other things out there, and I don't claim to have looked at all the alternatives and done a perfect analysis of that. Okay, what's the conclusion here? I think it makes sense for an effective altruist to give according to the expected value, the probability of the impact times the value of the impact. There's costs of delaying until you get perfect evidence. There's costs of being so ambiguity averse you wait for perfect proof. And it's therefore important to take all the evidence that you have, sum it together, and come up with some estimate of the probability and some estimate of the value. And that's not going to be perfect, but we should recognize it. And then when we should collect additional evidence, well, that's the same criteria, and that's typically, which is, do the benefits, expected benefits of the additional evidence outweigh the costs? And I would argue, typically, that's going to mean that you keep collecting evidence long after, even long after you've decided that, based on current evidence, you're going to take an action. So thank you very much. I should say I'm happy to talk to people afterwards outside. So.